Geopolitical Horizons, the podcast from thegeopolitics.com. Today we want to step back from our usual podcast and look at the basic building blocks of geopolitics. We all know how difficult it is to make sense of the world, and this is why we're here. The majority of questions that we receive from you guys at Geopolitics and when we do our analysis is, how do we actually join up the dots? What's the methodology behind Geopolitics? Now, we've got Adnan Khan, the founder of Geopolitics, to help us navigate through this topic. How are you keeping, Adnan?
I'm good, Yusuf. I'm good. How are you?
I'm brilliant. Thank you. Now, Adnan, the first question is, at any given moment in time, there's so much going on in the world, and it's sometimes so overwhelming we don't even know where to begin. I remember when we had our discussion about Strategic Estimate 2023, and again, there was so much to take in. Anyone who approaches this topic of geopolitics, where's the best place to begin?
Well, thanks, Yusuf. I think you're right. It's a very important discussion. And, you know, most of our podcasts are really about specific political issues, a political event that's happened. I mean, recently we've been talking a lot about the Ukraine war. And I think it is important we take a step back and, in effect, have a look at the methodology of making sense of the world. Now, I usually feel a good place to start the basic building blocks, as you said, is start of a question, really. How many countries are there in the world? If you have a look, there's obviously many countries. I mean, it does depend on how you define a country. But you find on average, there's about 200 countries in the world. Now, nobody would say every country is the same. Nobody would say every country is equal. What we find is all nations around the world are very different, all 200 of them. So you find many are in poverty. You find some are living in abundance. You find some have a lot of technology. You find other countries don't. You also find that there are some countries that do a lot of things beyond their borders. Whilst other countries, such as Finland, such as Congo, such as New Zealand, they don't really do much beyond their borders. You find other countries want to get involved and shape and solve issues in other regions. So America, for example, is heavily involved in the Middle East. It's heavily involved in Europe. Now, not all countries do that. So the point here really is not all countries are the same. Although there are 200 countries in the world, most of them do not engage in shaping the rest of the world. So really the most important countries in the world, the ones that we need to be following, are the ones that do engage beyond their borders. And what you find is there's not many of these sort of countries. If you want, we can call it who are the Premier League of nations. And you find, I mean, we can debate this. You have America, you have Russia, you have Britain, you have France, you have Germany, you have China. That's six countries. So out of the 200 countries in the world, the ones that you need to follow are these six. And why do you need to follow these six? Because these six countries are the nations that are trying to shape the world. They do a lot of politics. They do a lot of actions beyond their borders. I think that's a good starting point, and then you can build upon that.
Adnan, I like the way you put that, the Premier League. Now, how do I make sense of these particular countries, these six countries, and what they are doing, what they are planning? Like, I can sometimes follow statements that their leaders are saying, their visits by the ambassadors, but it's still quite confusing. Can you give me any direction on that?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right, Yusuf. Just because you've identified the Premier League of Nations on its own, it just tells you which countries are important. What that principle doesn't tell you is what are these individual countries up to? What are they specifically doing? Knowing who the Premier League of Nations are just tells you who are the important nations. It doesn't actually give you any more detail. So what that means is we need more, slightly more detailed principles to help us. And this is where things like history, this is where things like ideology, these sort of things come in. So nations are obviously quite big things. They are institutions, they are people, they are people's culture. And obviously not all countries are the same. But if you now look at the ideas, the values, or the ideology a nation carries, that allows you to get some understanding of how a country views the world and what they're up to. So if we look at countries like America, Britain, and France, these are capitalist nations. They believe in democracy, they believe in liberal values, and they want to promote these around the world. So they promote the United Nations, they promote human rights. They obviously contradict themselves sometimes, which we can look into, but By understanding the ideology these nations are built upon, it allows you to gain a much clearer picture of what are they up to around the world. So one of the arguments against Russia's invasion of Ukraine that's come from the West is this goes against the nation state model. Nation states means each nation is a sovereign nation and this has to be respected. This is a Western idea. Nation states really is a Western concept that was developed by them and exported around the world. So this is why they stand against Russia, or one of the reasons they stand against Russia. The other principle that can help is history. If you take Pakistan and India, their relationship is defined by their history. There was a divorce, which is called partition, and they've had a very unhappy divorce where they're at each other's throats since then. So knowing that history will allow you to understand what's going on between India and Pakistan. Tibet and China, the only way to understand their relationship is to look at historically what happened. And that gives you a good picture. Ukraine as well. You can understand Ukraine if you look at the history. It's always been a buffer country between Europe and Russia. And then sometimes if you look at geography, the location countries are in. So Poland, for example, where it is explains 99% of what the country's up to. Poland has always been the route invaders have passed by. So whether it was Napoleon, whether it was the Germans, or whether it was the Russians. So looking at the ideology nations are based upon, looking at their history and looking at the geography of the location they're in, that actually helps us understand a bit more about particular nations.
Now, a few questions I've got in regards to those points that you made. First of all, history is a big one. How far back in history do you go? Sometimes I found myself, when I've been reading about history, I'm so engrossed in the historical aspect of that particular nation that I forget what's going on in the world at that particular time. Where do I prioritize?
So what I found, Yusuf, is, let me pose a question to you. Germany, America, Britain are capitalist nations, they're liberal nations, but they're not the same, they're very different. And the only way for you to understand this is to look at their history. The way these countries have evolved, the way they became capitalist nations, actually has defined who they are. So the only way to understand that is you've got to look at their history. So the advantage with Germany is Germany only came together as a country in 1871. So you don't need to go that far back. If you want to understand the history of Europe, you probably do need to go quite far back. But this is something you do over time. It's not an exam. It's not something you need to know now. But what you tend to find is sometimes for you to make sense of something today, to get a more crystallized picture, going back and looking at the history, a recent history that is, does actually give you a more crystallized picture. What I'd say is you will not necessarily be able to do political analysis because you know history. But what history will do is a tool that does make things clearer for you. But you're right. What's going on in front of me? There's a war going on in Ukraine. You've got different nations involved. So you need to look at what each nation are up to. But if you actually just look at recent history, what you'll find is the last 20 years, Ukraine's been fought over. You'll find for the last 600 years, the border between Europe and Russia has constantly moved. So really, the battle for Ukraine today is just the modern version of an age-old battle. So that, in that sense, you do need to know about history. It gives you a more crystallized picture. However, I wouldn't go overboard. You know, really, to understand what's going on, you've got to look at what are the different players up to? What are they trying to achieve? What are their stated goals? What are the physical actions they are doing? I think it is important you don't miss the point. That's what you need to do. What history does, it does crystallize it more for you. If you know lots about history, but you don't understand what's going on in front of you, history won't give you that answer. And that's why it's a good question. I think it's important we put these both into perspective.
Ideology. So when I look at the world, I generally see the world upon a liberal capitalist ideology. So wouldn't that mean that most of the world, especially the Premier League and those not far behind, wouldn't they all have the same direction ultimately?
Yeah, so in theory, that's absolutely correct. In practice, it doesn't quite work like that. And in fact, in practice, that is a bit black and white. So for example, if we take the example of America, America is a capitalist liberal nation, but it's done many things that are very illiberal. It's done many things that go against human rights. America has a relationship with countries who don't even have elections. Like Saudi Arabia just never had elections. It's not exactly a democratic nation. So this actually shows you where you've got to be careful here. Sometimes your principles don't neatly fit in the reality. And it is important to be aware of this. And this brings us to quite an important point, which is that politics and making sense of the world, this is a discipline very different from other disciplines. If you look at literature, if you look at law, if you look at economics, psychology, any other subject area, you have principles, you have theories, and the subject area is quite defined. Politics doesn't really work like that. Politics is very fluid. And that's because you're talking about people, groups of people, nations. You're not talking, you know, things aren't black and white. In fact, things are very fluid. This is why following the world, making sense of the world, is very difficult, because things are constantly changing. The motivation in people are constantly changing. In fact, it's debatable, do you even have all the information at any given time? So that's why politics, a lot of it is making best judgment, making the best judgment you can on the incomplete information you have. And then as things evolve, you adjust, you make changes. So that's why this is a very difficult subject. And that's why I'm not surprised. The most asked question we have is, how do we make sense of the world? And how do I put the puzzle together? Because it is actually difficult. You are engaging in an activity that is very difficult. Vladimir Putin thought Russia could just roll into Kiev, the capital of Ukraine, and overthrow the leadership. That was his analysis. In fact, that was everybody's analysis. Ukraine has no chance. It's a corrupt country. The ruler is very unpopular, which he was. And the army, there isn't one really, right? Everybody got it. Everyone's analysis was wrong. It didn't turn out that way. So don't be afraid to get it wrong. You will get it wrong. The difference when we get it wrong is we're doing analysis. There's no implications. When people like Vladimir Putin and leaders get it wrong, there's implication, as we're seeing with Russia.
And now, what other tools or concepts can be used to make this task a little bit easier for us? And on top of that, you know, when we're looking at countries domestically, how much does that have a part to play in things that globally and their foreign policy?
Okay, so there are probably a few more principles that can help guide us make sense of the world. The first of these is we have to accept the world is always in a flux. What that means is things are constantly changing. They never remain the same. In fact, the first principle of politics is things always change. And that's actually what makes it difficult. The moment you get it, things change. And the reason for this is because national power, it constantly changes. Nations get stronger, nations get weaker. So to give you two examples, the British Empire, from the time it defeated Napoleon, 1815, up to the First World War, was the global superpower. The sun never set on the British Empire. It had global military bases. It was ruling over India. It was indirectly ruling over Egypt and China. Nobody could compete with it. Then World War I happened and things changed. China, during this period, was occupied by all these different European countries. After World War I, it was occupied by Japan. After World War II, it got independence, but nevertheless, despite being a large country, it had zero global influence because domestically it was broken. It was a poor country. But that's not the reality today. The reality today now is China is an industrial monster. It's the second largest economy in the world. Its military is growing, and you've got to take it seriously. So these two examples show us things are always in a flux. Things always change. Nations get stronger, nations get weaker. This nation gets stronger and weaker. This is the international situation. The international situation is the superpower and the nations that compete with it. And this constantly changes. Nations get stronger, nations get weaker. Britain and France are probably on their way out of the Premier League of Nations. China is on its way up. Germany is debatable. Are they going to stay in the global Premier League or are they going? Countries like Mexico, countries like Russia, countries like Turkey, they are probably on their way up. And this is the first principle, which I think is important. So what that means, Yusuf, is we have to accept things are not, they're always changing. So it means we need to keep up to date with things and then assess what's actually changing. The other thing we need to keep in mind is throughout history, there has always been competition between different states, peoples, societies. From the beginning of time, the Romans fought the Persians. The Romans and the Persians fought the Muslim Caliphate, the Islamic Caliphate. The Islamic Caliphate fought the Christians of Europe in the Crusades. The Mongols fought everybody. The British Empire fought the French. It fought the Dutch. It fought the Spanish, it fought the Germans, the Americans fought the Russians and the Soviets, now defying China. So what you find is competition between states is a constant. And this competition, it then takes place out there in the world. So Ukraine really, Yusuf, is a proxy battle. It's a proxy battle between the West on one side led by America and Russia. Really, Ukraine is the proxy, and these nations are competing over it. And in fact, if you look at the world, 90% of issues are due to the competition between these states. If you look at North Korea, that really is competition between China and America. We talked about Ukraine. If you look at Libya, if you look at Yemen, if you look at all the issues, these are competition between the European powers and America. So competition between states is another way to understand what's going on in the world. And the final is, there has always been global struggle. And global struggle tends to be for two reasons. One is for supremacy, and the other one is for resources. So you find the Nazis believed they were superior to everybody. They wanted supremacy for the people. The communists and the Muslim Caliphate, they believed they had superior values and systems. So they wanted to make their value system supreme over everybody else. And then for the last 200-300 years, we've seen with the rise of the European powers, there's been a scramble for global resources, whether it's oil, coal, and technology. So these three things, Yusuf, things are always in a flux, competition between states and international struggle for supremacy and resources. These are further principles that will help us understand what's going on in the world.
League and those who are in competition with these leading countries. What about the vassal states? Where do they fall into all this?
So vassal states is not a new concept. This is something that has existed throughout history. And what you really find is, if you are going to have a global presence, this is going to take up a lot of resources. It will overstretch you. So one way to get around that is, rather than sending your military around the world, what if you could get other nations to implement your agenda? What if you could get other rulers who would use their resources in line with what you want to achieve? And this is where this concept of vassal states or agent states comes about. Now, what that means is, I mentioned at the beginning, there's 200 countries in the world. Only 5 or 6 are global power. The rest are not. Now, some of these countries are vassals for other countries. So you find Egypt and Pakistan. These are really vassal states for America. They implement America's agenda. America, over the years, has grown its control and influence over these countries. And these countries' leaders believe it's in their interests to be part of America's global agenda. They don't have their own agenda. They believe the more they get used, that's a good thing for them. So building vassal states is something the global powers do. So if you look at the Middle East, Yusuf, that was created by Britain and France. Now, all the monarchies in the Middle East, the Saudi royal family, the Gulf states, the Jordanian monarchy, these were established by Britain. These were tribes who used to fight each other. And the tribe that turned out to be loyal to Britain, Britain gifted them their own countries and put them into power. And now these countries are loyal to them. So vassal states absolutely is a reality. And it's an extension of the global powers. It's a very cost-effective tool to achieve their global policies. And that's why once America emerged a power after World War II, it actively worked to overthrow nations which were vassals to France and Britain. So you find the first coup America carried out in the Middle East was in Syria, but its most important one was in Egypt when Gamal Abdel Nasser came to power. And what Gamal Abdel Nasser did is he overthrew the British-supported monarchy in Egypt. That's what he achieved. So yeah, you know, vassal states are, they exist, they are important. And probably the best way to understand them is if you were to use a model. On one side of the spectrum, you've got an independent nation. That country is independent domestically, and it itself decides its foreign policy. On the opposite end, you have a nation where it doesn't decide its foreign policy, another nation does, and another nation actually has some say over its domestic policy as well. And then you've got the whole area in between. And that's probably a good way to actually look at it. If you are doing actions which aid the global power, then you are effectively a tool of that power, whether you know it or not. And that's very effective for a power. It's very cost effective. And obviously it's not very good for vassal nation. But that's why you find America, Britain, France, they have deep relations with countries. They have engagement with the political parties, with the armies, and they try to develop them. So absolutely, it is important when we look at other nations that we can identify, firstly, are they vassal nations? If they are, then who are their vassals for? Because then that will help us understand what this country is doing.
We've spoken a bit about nation states, but there are many other views on this. So some people believe that there's a small, very small group of elite people and they control the world. And many people talk about the Great Reset and it being a front for this group of globalists. How do we square all this up?
So, although our discussion, Yusuf, up until now has been about nation states, a nation state really is, you know, the term means you have a state, an executive authority, and in theory, it's there to represent the nation, the specific people who have come together. So people who've come together because they have a certain culture, a certain language. But we have to ask the question, who do governments really represent? Because the feeling in the West is, from the masses, governments don't represent them. Governments more and more seem to represent the 1%. They seem to represent the rich. They seem to represent big business. They seem to represent transnational companies who have a lot of influence because they have resources and they have economic power. So this is why it's not surprising more and more people can see. I mean, the amount, I mean, in the UK where we are, Yusuf, 20% of the population suffers from fuel poverty. This week, Yusuf, the supermarkets have run out of fruit and vegetables. Now, how is that possible in the fifth, sixth richest nation in the world, which generates trillions of pounds every year? But those trillions of pounds only go to a small percentage. So not everyone is the same in these nations. And that's why I'm not surprised more and more people believe these views. Now, you mentioned the Great Reset. You mentioned these globalists. And the Great Reset or World Economic Forum, they don't hide what their agenda is. So every year they meet in Davos. They get together all the world's influential people, government officials, companies, and they talk about what their agenda is for the world. They talk about what they want to see. So the Great Reset was the annual get-together they had during COVID, and they're very open. They said, whilst COVID is really, really bad, it presents a unique opportunity to reset the global system. And then some of the things they talk about are, by 2030, you will own nothing, you will be happy. Meaning they had some ideas about establishing smart grids, central bank digital currency, movement licenses, mandatory medical procedures, and social credit systems. And just to give you a quote, David Rockefeller, very famous rich individual from America who had his finger in many, many pies, he in his memoir says, and I'll quote him, "Some even believe we are part of a secret cabal working against the best interests of the United States to build a more integrated global political and economic structure, one world, if you will. If that's the charge, I stand guilty and I'm proud of it." So he was actually very open what he wants to achieve. So these individuals, what they want is a centralized system where they sit at the top. So for them, it's really about control and power. That's what it's really about. And you find that many nations, these individuals have a big say over policy. So these guys are very open about how they want to see the world. Their view is some of the things that have come out over COVID, they want to see that permanently implemented in part of the world. So they want people to have vaccine passports. They want to do away with currency. You just have a digital currency. Obviously, it means they will be at the center of all, controlling it all. So again, this is very important. It is something we need to be aware of. And I think there is a general consensus out there, Yusuf, that although we've got nations in the world, it's not the government that really runs these countries. You have other elite individuals in these countries. So it is important. So if these countries are a means to an end, then we do need to understand what their agenda is and what they're up to. So absolutely, the way we square it up is we need to understand what are they up to and what are they doing. And obviously, most of the global architecture we have, these guys have supported it. They've actually built it. So when they're saying we need a reset, what they're saying now is this system has run as far as it can and we need to make changes. And obviously you can see there's a lot of opposition to this as well.
Now, we briefly touched on the global liberal order. Where does this actually fit in this discussion? Where does things like the dollar fit in this discussion?
So the global liberal order, Yusuf, is quite unique because if you look at historically, we've never had a global order. You have empires that got close to it. But what you find is the order was established by them conquering a large chunk of the world. What happened after World War II was America was the last man standing. The world was devastated. The Soviet Union was about to become very influential. So what America did, rather than controlling the whole world directly by occupying them, America established an order which in many ways shaped every country. So what the global liberal order was, it was a global order that established a number of institutions that the whole world would work with. And this order would establish the liberal order. So it was in the competition with the communist order. So what you find, NATO was established as a security guarantor for the world. The IMF and the World Bank was established for economic development and financial capital flows. The General Agreement, GATT, the General Agreement on Taxes and Tariffs was established, would eventually turn into World Trade Organization. And what that was a trading order, where you have very, very low tariffs. We obviously find that the dollar was established as the global currency. So America's domestic currency became the global currency. So this order, it led to a lot of economic prosperity. It led to massive growth in GDP. And actually, it was the reason, one of the main reasons, why the Soviet Union collapsed in the end. The Soviet Union couldn't keep up. The countries that were part of the Soviet communist order, they just didn't see the same economic development. So because America established this, so if someone doesn't like America, if America doesn't like them, America can punish them by cutting them off from the system. So you find North Korea, Cuba, Iran, and now Russia, when America wants to punish them, it cuts them off from this order and they suffer immensely. So really, America was unique. America established an indirect way to rule over the whole world. A direct way would mean you've got to physically occupy them, which just takes too many resources. And this liberal order was based on some values, and those values are free markets, human rights, democracy would lead to you being happier, would lead to more prosperity. And obviously this came after the devastation of World War II. So the global liberal order is very important to understand. This is it's an extension of America's influence around the world. It does look as though, Yusuf, that the global liberal order has run its course. Even in America, a lot of officials are now turning against it. Because what they find, although it helped America in the Cold War against the Soviet Union, countries like China have benefited from it. A lot of companies in America have shut up manufacturing and shifted to other parts of the world, because under liberal order, you could do that. We're one big market. So a lot of people in America feel the global liberal order now doesn't help us anymore. In fact, it actually has led to unemployment. It led to jobs going abroad. So you're seeing in America now, there's a lot more talk of ending the liberal order and going back to just bilateral relationships with other countries.
A selection of the current issues that are going on at the moment. I just want your views on it. Quick and snappy, Adnan. So the US decline.
Okay, so I think this is important. We've talked a lot about how to make sense of things and we've stepped back. We obviously now need to apply this. And I think American decline is probably one of the most important discussions. And all this really is, America was the last man standing after World War II. It defeated the Soviet Union in 1991. For the next decade, there was a talk of the 21st century being the American century. And the America felt, or America's rulers, that the best use of American power was to create regime change against unfavorable countries. So they invaded Iraq and Afghanistan, and what a disaster they turned out to be. So during that period, America's image, America's credibility, America's power has been hit. During this period, Russia and China have emerged more powerful. So there is a big discussion at the moment that America seems to be at the end of its global power status. And this has big implications because America shaped the world since World War II. America shaped the world unilaterally since 1991. So this is quite an important trend to actually follow.
The rise of China.
America doesn't hide this. The biggest competitor America feels that can challenge it, that is trying to challenge it, is China. China, you're absolutely right. Russia tries to challenge America, but there's a capabilities issue. But the nation that seems to be building its capabilities is China. I think for the moment, China needs to become the dominant power in its region. Although China talks a lot about world affairs and global institutions, there's nothing much it can really do about them at the moment. Until China doesn't become secure in its own region, once it does that, then it can start competing with America globally. For the moment, China doesn't challenge America globally. What China is trying to do is challenge America in its own region. And America's quite fearful of this because China's in the region and China has the capability. So we need to watch this, because if China is able to become the dominant power in its region, then it can then start expanding into other regions.
Where does Russia fit into all this?
So Yusuf, if we did this podcast a year ago, I would have said Russia is trying to challenge America in the former Soviet republics. Russia is very unhappy that it's not number one and America is. And Russia has some influence in different regions of the world to change this. Far forward to today, Russia has clearly showed it lacks military power. Russia has shown that Ukraine, which it says we're one country, is that to invade them, which shows you it hasn't won their hearts and minds. So I think Russia is a power. However, I think it's a very weak, great power. However, if you're the global power, you have to keep an eye on your enemies. And Russia is one of them. Russia is a large country. Russia has former Soviet republics where it has lots of influence. And Russia keeps attacking the global liberal order, where other countries are taking this seriously as well. So that's really where Russia fits in.
What about the Muslim world?
Okay, so Yusuf, 2 billion people. 2 billion people who are unhappy with the state of affairs. 2 billion people who are still growing. So they want to see economic development. They want jobs. They want housing. They want energy resources. And our rulers are unable to provide them because they're corrupt and because they don't want to, and because they want to loot the nation's wealth all for themselves. So 10-ish years ago, we had the Arab Spring, and some rulers left, other rulers survived, and we're still back at the same position again. I mean, if it wasn't for COVID, where a lot of lockdowns happened, I think we would already had an uprising. So this is a very important trend to watch, Yusuf, because the things are bubbling in Egypt, in Pakistan, in Lebanon, in Iraq, in Iran, in Algeria, in Sudan. In all these countries, people are unhappy, and the rulers trying different things, mainly the iron fist, to try and maintain power. So what happened in the Muslim world, 2 billion people, will have an impact on the whole world. So it's a very important trend to watch.
Going on from there, what about this idea of the power shifting from the West to the East? Can capitalism endure?
Okay, so yeah, these are more long-term trends, Yusuf. There is some serious question marks over capitalism. The economic inequality, the environmental degradation, the corruption in politics is leading to people questioning the liberal system. And I think there is a serious question mark. Can capitalism endure in the long run? If you look at the moment, Yusuf, they seem to be getting around this by just... Most of the economic problems are dealt with by just printing loads of money. Most economic problems are dealt with by bringing in rulers or people who are on the left. But there are some serious question marks, and a lot of people are questioning this now, that the politics isn't working, democracy that is, the economic situation, there's a lot of economic inequality even in the West. I mean, there's actually significant poverty. So there is actually a debate, and I think this is actually quite a serious issue, which in the long run will have implications, because in 1991, it was the end of history. It was the end of the development of ideas. Capitalism had won. But within two decades, we see capitalism is actually struggling, and capitalism isn't struggling because there's an alternative system. It's actually struggling because the contradictions inherent in it are all being seen. So whilst there's all this talk about the free market and freedom of ownership, what people see is the 1% of the world seem to own half of the wealth of the world. So that definitely is a long-term trend. You talked about its power shifting from the West to East. Yes, the rise of China, the rise of Japan. For the last 500 years, the West or Europe was the epicenter of the world. And with manufacturing, with global GDP, with more of the global population being in the East, we may really be seeing the shift from the West being the epicenter of the world to it shifting to the East.
Interesting point about demographics. There is a global demographic decline. Any comments on that?
Yes, I think this is actually quite an important trend. For decades, I remember when I was at university, the problem the world faces is too many people in the world. There's not enough water. There's not enough energy, there's not enough food, there will be global catastrophe. And very quickly, we've gone from there to there's not enough people in the world. In fact, most of the world's population is in decline. What you find, Yusuf, is global fertility, so the number of children per woman, that has been dropping for a long time. So you find already the Western nations are already there, their populations are in decline, Germany, Japan. If you look at countries like America, their population would be in decline if it wasn't for immigration. And most European countries, it's immigration that's keeping their population afloat. However, you find China now, its population is slowing. It's going to start declining soon. America, I think last year, for the first time, it said its overall population now is not growing. It's actually starting to go the other way. Now, why is this important? The reason why this is important, Yusuf, is the size of your population affects everything. It affects the size of your army, it affects the size of your economy, it affects how much taxes are being paid, how much budget the government has, so it affects the economy. So if your population is decreasing, it has an impact on everything. And you find the countries that seem to be having the largest reduction in population sizes, yeah, is actually the Western nations, is these countries. The nations that are still growing, although not at the rate they were a few decades ago, are countries in Africa, are in the Muslim world and the Far East. So global demographic decline is probably one of the most important long-term trends.
Something a little closer to home, can the EU survive?
I don't think in its current form it can, Yusuf. I think with Britain leaving, it's exposed the issues. Nationalism is tearing the EU apart. Even though you have a union of states in Europe, each state still fights for its own interests within the union, which has really fractured the EU. I think in the long run, I don't think it can survive in its current form. I think what you'll find is you'll have a two-tier system. You'll have the richer northern countries and the poorer southern countries. I think that's what you're going to see. And really, the EU was supposed to solve the perennial problem Europe had of they kept going to wars with each other. And what they thought was, if we create a union and create economic prosperity, we can put to bed nationalism. But what you find is nationalism is a very emotive idea. It doesn't just disappear. The Germans, the Russians, the French, the British, they've always been at war. A little bit of economic prosperity isn't going to end that. And you're seeing it's back, the fact that Britain's left. You're seeing the rise of anti-EU parties across Europe because they feel they've had enough of the European Union. So definitely, I think I don't think the EU will survive in its current form in the long run.
Now, this is a topic which not many people think about, but the fight for space.
So I think this is probably a podcast we need to do on its own as well, Yusuf, actually, now that you actually mentioned it. But in a nutshell, you know, the oceans have all been conquered. The land geography has all been conquered. And really, the future now will be out there into space. And what we mean by that is the area from here to the moon. What you're finding now is obviously all the resources we need are out there in the universe. Yeah, you know, gold, energy, everything like that. So there's a lot more focus now on building the architecture, the infrastructure, where we can go out into not deep space, but into the area around the Earth to the moon and really find other resources. You can mine resources from asteroids. You can mine them from the moon. So we're at the early stage of this at the moment as well. So there is a lot of collaboration in this particular area, but that's probably going to be the future going forward. Now, we don't really have a framework for this because all our framework is Earth-based. You know, geopolitics, geography, economics is all based upon people, humans, engaging, interacting. So this is probably something to watch in the more longer run. And we probably need a podcast on its own for this, really, to have a look at this in a bit more detail. And what it involves and how to make sense of it. But I think it's good you raised it because it is something we do need to be aware of or have a look at because this will actually have an impact on politics and geopolitics going forward.
That's definitely a good idea, Adnan. Thank you for your time today, Adnan. This is hopefully the first of this type of series on how to make sense of the world. So please, guys, subscribe and follow us. You can also learn more on other issues by accessing our website where you'll find comprehensive insights. I'm Yusuf. Thank you for listening.